You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for July 24th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the Learning Annex, where Rand Paul's scrapbooking class is already in progress. It's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Hey, I'm Rand Paul.
Poor Rand.
I'm so glad he's scrapbooking all this stuff that's happening.
Yeah. You saw what he did, right?
Yeah, he cut up the tax code with a chainsaw.
With safety glasses and chain. He essentially, it's like, what, a Vonage commercial?
Yeah.
You know?
Cut your bills in half, people.
And it's because no one's paying any attention to him.
Yeah.
He is on the list of people who are going to be sitting at home watching the Fox News debate unless he gets some attention. So he thought, hey, here we go. And it's endemic. It's across the board. All the candidates are doing it. But this chopping up the tax code, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a tax code.
You know, okay, great. Nice stunt. But nobody's going to outstunt Donald Trump.
Well, and future political science textbooks
yes.
are going to write about this particular year.
Yes.
As the way to lose the White House 16 months out.
Yeah.
First of all, hand over all of the decision-making process to the propaganda network that depends on ratings.
Yes.
In order to determine who your candidate's going to be.
Yeah, because that'll work.
That'll work.
That's a good idea.
And set loose the number one celebrity on network TV,
uh-huh.
who is crazy and yeah. just as crazy as your base, to parrot your base's id
yeah.
for them.
Reflect it right back to them.
Reflect it right back to them.
Uh-huh.
And then also, I think also the interchangeability of so many of the other candidates.
Yeah.
Really, the difference between Bobby Jindal and Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
They're the same guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of that is these are the cookie cutters that the Koch brothers have. And they like the shape of this cookie.
Exactly. And they're all pretty much on board with all of the Koch brothers' talking
mm-hmm.
points.
Mm-hmm.
So they become indistinguishable from one another except by virtue of their frosting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I want to just mention as an aside, I want to thank you, Driftglass, for Sunday night. You pulled me away from social media.
Yes.
And seriously, folks, I thought it crossed my mind that I might have to go to the hospital. I'm serious. It was just getting to the point of being depressed, and not depressed sad. Depressed black, depressed
yes.
dark place.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs in my family, and I don't have it very often at all. In fact, maybe three times in the past 15 years has this happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I recognize it.
Yep.
When it happens, like, whoa, I know where this is. I've been down this cave. I've been in this cave before, and fortunately, I have a partner in life
mm-hmm.
Who I feel very safe with, and I can say to him, I'm in this cave right now, and you pulled me away from television and every screen in the house.
No more Twitter for you.
No more Twitter for you for a while.
No more social media.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, you need to just step away from all of this
for a little while. No more steeping yourself in yeah. problems of the world.
Right. Well, and Twitter in particular becomes shouty crackers
yeah.
and substanceless
yeah.
And angry and not ending. I mean, that Twitter is always running and
yep.
there's always 168 new tweets and you can't climb out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's not Twitter's fault and that's not any person's fault, but you have to... You have to take it as you can take it rather than just take a bath in it
Well, and I have an unfair advantage.
Unconsciously, you know.
I have an unfair advantage.
Which is?
You and I have a deal.
Yeah, we do. We do have a deal.
Only one of us can be crazy at any given time.
Only one of us can lose it.
Right. And that's a pretty good deal.
That's a pretty good deal.
It's stood us in good stead so far. But, you know, my family background and my Irish family background, my alcoholism running in the family background, my radar for this kind of thing is very, very sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I've been there.
Yeah.
So I know that, oh, no, this is, quick, doctor, give her some drugs. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, honey? Cheer up. Come on, look.
Have another drink. You'll be fine.
Happy smiley face. Look, it's poppies. No. You don't understand. Depression doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way.
Nope. At all. It reminds me vaguely. I'm going to throw in some West Wing on you here.
Oh, no. You never do that.
I know.
Oh, wait.
I haven't done that in a long time. That. So I'll go West Wing, David Brooks, Glenn Greenwald, then go back to West Wing for see if I can put you back in a depression. It was the chief of staff explaining to someone who had basically hurt him really badly about alcoholism, and he was explaining, well, why don't you stop? Because I'm an alcoholic. Well, you know, how about after a drink? No, I want 9 drinks.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I'm an alcoholic. You know, that is the definition of the disease. And depression is similar in a lot of ways. It's not a mood.
No.
It is an affliction that comes upon you very quickly sometimes and is overwhelming. And you can cope with it, but it's a real thing. Mm-hmm. And I have the same problem every now and then. A lot of people do. And I'm delighted that my partner understands that as well, reciprocally understands that as well. So it's nothing to do with the outside world, but
no.
The outside world needs to go away sometime.
Yep, yep.
And soaking in this fucking lunatic sideshow, freak show of a political season is not necessarily good for your mental health if you do it all day, every day.
And you're not conscious of your ability to step away from it and the need to step away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, good class. Getting back into it.
Yeah.
You had an interesting comment this week about a character named George Wellington Streeter.
Yeah.
Who is that? And explain that who that guy is to people.
For you Chicago fans or Chicagoans, everyone knows where Streeterville is in Chicago. It's a neighborhood. It's an area in Chicago. And it's named after a guy named George Wellington Cap Streeter. And he was a con man and a bootlegger and just a general nefarious kind of scheming opportunist. And his legend says one thing, and the actual facts of the case are substantially different. But the upshot is he ran his houseboat aground on a sandbar. Or he parked it there with the permission of the owner of the lakefront there. But he left it there. And it was a place where the city was bulldozing a lot of the debris from the Chicago fire into the lakefront. Just getting rid of it. Your whole city is burned down. It's full of rubble and God knows what toxic crap. Just shove it in the lake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what he saw was, oh, you're making new real estate. Excellent. And he parked his boat in the middle of it and declared himself to be essentially the king of it. And he said, no, this isn't part of Illinois. It doesn't abide by the laws of Illinois. This is a brand new district. And we don't abide by the laws of Illinois because it's a brand new place.
And this was during Prohibition, right?
This was before Prohibition.
Oh, okay.
But there were dry laws and wet laws and what you can and can't do and who can and can't serve liquor. And he said, fuck that. There were prostitution was going on there, illegal drinking was going on there. He was selling plots of land there because this isn't Illinois, it's not Chicago, this is my territory. And every so often the cops would come in and try to clear him out and there'd be a running gun battle. And he and his first or second wife lived out there and they got themselves another boat and they did the same thing. And Essentially, he invented a new place on the map and declared himself to be king of the place. And that location is now where the John Hancock Building is built.
$1 billion worth of real estate, not owned by Donald Trump, actually.
No, but it's it was nothing. It was a wasteland. It was a sandbar and rubble until this guy just stood on top of it and said, "Nope, this is now a new neighborhood. This is now a completely new place, and I'm in charge of it, and I'm going to start selling deeds." And he was a con man, but he has a statue there. And when he died, the mayor of Chicago, I forget who the mayor was at the time, went to his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an act of absolute arrogant fuck you to the powers at City Hall when he just said, no, I don't follow you. I don't abide by your rules. This plot of land isn't part of your city or state. Mm-hmm. It's mine. And I get to do whatever the hell I want with it. It just happens to be smack in the middle of your area here, but it's mine. Mm-hmm. And this so reminds me of Donald Trump and the art of the deal.
Yeah.
Because this is not if you look at the Trump thing as a there's a lot of different lenses to look through. One of which is one very valid one is the fact that he is the Republican base. He just reflects it back at them just like Rush Limbaugh does. And the people who the serious candidates, you know, who are crazy in their own way, are all dependent on getting that crazy base to side with them. And they're presented with an insolvable problem, which is how do I get the base away from the crazy man? How do I divorce the two?
Mm-hmm.
How do I condemn his vocabulary but embrace his issues? How do I lure his nut jobs into my boat without calling them crazy? And I think that, and that's a valid way of looking at Donald Trump, but I think it is very helpful to look at it as a real estate deal.
Mm.
Donald Trump understands real estate.
Yeah.
Donald Trump understands taking worthless real estate and declaring it to be awesome and then selling it or valuing it for much, much, much higher than it is. Real estate is a real thing. It exists in the world, but it's as much.
The real estate market is based entirely on what people think
exactly.
It should be worth.
It's perception. Yeah. So every 4 years, the Republican Party has to rebuild an entire campaign for somebody to run for president on the same toxic waste dump that they did 4 years before and 4 years before that. And there's no getting around the fact that the central choicest land, the most important plot of land on their diagram is the base of the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have those people. If those people desert you or they stay home, you lose. You lose horribly. You lose everything. So you have to have those people on board. And Donald Trump just walked out, just rode his houseboat in the middle of it and said, "This is mine now. I declare that this is mine." And he's done everything he can do to pander and appease the base directly. He's made out of red meat.
Yeah.
And it is a vexing problem both for the GOP and for the mainstream media. And I'm convinced what he wants to do is up the value of the land he has claimed until someone pays him for it.
Yeah.
No. You know, Roger Ailes says, I'll give you 3 years on Fox. Somebody will make it worth his financial while or whatever appeals to
him. Or his ego while.
Or his ego while to give
to
up that.
Save face and gain something.
And he will take what is essentially a toxic piece of land and flip it into something that makes him richer or more valuable or more powerful or more influential or whatever it is he wants. But understanding this is a real estate deal really does sort of open the door to what he's doing and why he's doing it and why it's working. Because if you are in the mainstream media, if you're an enabler of the Republican Party, you cannot say that the problem is the Republican Party is full of Republicans.
Yeah.
You just can't do that. So he, you know, throws an elbow at John McCain. Okay. Good for him. That's great. And what happens to him after he attacks John McCain for 30 seconds? Because that line was a throwaway line, right? It was 30 seconds.
Well, I was thinking that it was kind of scary that you and I were going to come on this show and defend Donald Trump as telling, quote unquote, just a joke.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to do that.
No.
But it really was a throw. I mean, he was just sort of brushing aside what the moderator wanted to say, which is he's a war hero. And he said, you know, I want to talk about him calling my voters crazies.
Right.
And so I'm not going to talk about war hero. War hero. And that became the story.
And this is where I think it's very important to understand how the media works.
Yeah.
Because...
Yep. And I want, let me just say, I find it fascinating that a week ago, we were talking about Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yes, we were.
Versus David Brooks. That was the biggest story on Twitter on Friday.
Yep. Less than a week ago, as we record this, less than a week ago.
Mm-hmm. And that David Brooks had completely stepped in it, ruined his career almost. I mean, a lot of people were saying, this is it.
This
you know,
is, it's over. David Brooks is finally fucked
he's
up.
He's lecturing on from a position of complete and utter white privilege. At a person who has written a classic book on race relations. Mm-hmm. And here we are 6 days later.
Uh-huh.
And you talked about volume control in the media. Talk about that.
Well,
there's this kind of stereo going on.
If you pair these two stories, it gives you a binocular view. You know, the fact
I don't think we're not going to talk about Netroots Nation.
Oh, no.
We are. But, we
definitely
but
are.
We'll dovetail into that in a minute.
But this is a very specific... specific kind of thing. Donald Trump has said a great many horrible things that in a sane world would make mark him as completely unfit to be president at all, period. Okay, so let's get that out of the way. That's not what's at issue here. What's at issue is how does the media control what you see as news, what gets treated as news. Now, David Brooks shit the bed. There's no other way around. There's no other way to put it. He completely shit the bed on Friday. By over the weekend, not a single Sunday show mentioned him. One, he wasn't, and he's a guest on these shows. He's a lionized, respected, revered member of the village, and nobody said a fucking word. By Tuesday, story's gone. The story that was going to end his career is just gone, because they turned the volume down. We're not going to talk about it. No one, everyone, right across the board, a bunch of liberals are going to talk about it. Some people in Salon will mention it. That crazy Drift Glass, Charlie Pierce, but we'll just nope. It's not news. This isn't news. We declare it to be off limits, and so David Brooks. The big story is now not a story at all. Now, on the other end of the volume spectrum, Donald Trump says something really vicious and stupid about John McCain. 30 seconds. Throwaway line in the middle of a larger interview. Because he gets punched, he punches back. That's what he does. And the model they use is the Dean Scream.
Yeah.
It's, oh, here's this one snip. Now, in Howard Dean's case, it was one microphone that didn't pick up the crowd noise. What he was doing made perfect sense. He was rallying his troops. And if you heard it from any other perspective, it sounded like him out there sort of cheering him on. But the one microphone that deadened the sound, the crowd noise made him sound crazy. Well, the narrative about him is he's angry and nuts anyway, right? We don't want someone like Howard Dean running as the prohibitive favorite in the Democratic primary.
Right.
That's terrifying because he'll start talking about Iraq in ways we do not want to talk about Iraq. So let's destroy him. And how they destroy him? They took that one snip and they played it to fucking death.
Yep.
And they every single station beat that and beat that and beat that. And that's all he got asked about. And that's all he was. And after a week or two of absolutely raining shit down on him for every direction, he was through. They killed his candidacy based on a 30-second soundbite because they didn't want him. They didn't want his face associated with the race.
And you've heard that quote 3,000 times this week.
Yep. And what have you heard about Donald Trump? Again, not you heard from liberals talking about, well, what about all the horrible things he said about Mexican Americans, Mexicans, immigrants, about all the horrible things he said about everything else? No. The thing that disqualifies him is this 30-second throwaway he had about John McCain. That we can all get behind. That's crazy. And the media did exactly the same thing. They all played it to death, except this time it didn't work. Ha 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 ha. This time it didn't work because
they turned the volume right down on David Brooks. The whole story of David Brooks.
David Brooks went away. The Trump story, cranking it up on McCain, was supposed to kill him. But they forgot. He has all the free media in the world and all the money he wants.
Yeah.
So he doesn't give a shit. He'll just roll right over it. Anytime anybody asks him that question, he just bulldozes right through. He doubles down. And that's what they can't figure out how to control. That comment, repeated ad infinitum, should have killed his campaign, except for the fact that what it did instead was acted like, I mentioned this on the Nicole Sandler show, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It acted like a depth charge, because what it did was you had a whole bunch of Republicans lining up to be indignant about how dare you say something about John McCain. How dare you?
And all POWs, all veterans. Yeah.
And attacking the man's wall record. and attacking Tom McCain. What sort of monster would do a thing like that? Okay. Show of hands. Anybody remember the
Swift Boat? Swift Boat Veterans for Truth?
And that's where strategic forgettery becomes shines through. That's when the whole concept of you people are so good at forgetting the shit you did yesterday, of denying you ever said it. Your whole party is based on doing outrageous, vicious, evil shit today, and then denying as a group you ever said it or did it, that you forget that other people do remember the shit you did.
Mm-hmm.
We're just not allowed on television or radio to talk about it, but we remember. And so the minute they started bitching about attacking a man's war record and talking about John McCain, it's like, well, wait a minute. George Bush won the opportunity to steal the White House, won the primaries because of the vicious, slanderous, awful, rat-fucking attack on him, engineered by Ralph Reed and Karl Rove in a whisper campaign in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Yule didn't have a problem with that.
And also an activist Supreme Court. I mean, this is the funny part, too, is then they want to take on the Supreme Court. Supreme Court doesn't determine. Yeah, Rick Santorum was on Rachel last night saying the Supreme Court doesn't decide, isn't the final say on anything.
Yeah. Okay.
And Rachel Maddow had to say, well, I think you got your civics wrong.
Uh-huh.
You're wrong about civics, Senator.
After we got done remembering what fun times we had in 2000, people said, well, wait a minute, what about 2004?
Yeah.
What about the Swift Boat veterans? That wasn't a 30-second throwaway. That was a very carefully planned strategy of slander and lies that Jeb Bush congratulated them on.
And they found the letter Jeb Bush wrote to Swift Boat, the Swifties.
Uh-huh.
You Swifties are awesome.
And not a single Sunday show, except one, mentioned the Swift Boats. The liberals, we were right on that. We're like, wait a minute. Wait one goddamn minute. But not a single Sunday show, except hat tip to Jake Tapper.
Jake Tapper mentioned it.
He mentioned it, and they moved right along.
Yeah.
But the way that people coped with that, people coped with John McCain and his outbursts, was to roll out the both sided brigade.
Yeah.
You know, it just stick to the party line, because eventually this will stop being the story. But
and this is when Both Sider Brigade comes out and Netroots Nation hands them a both sider of, equally crazy on the left. Look how out of control they are.
That's Ruth Marcus. That's David Brooks in a dress. That's Ruth Marcus.
Yeah. Ruth Marcus, who, oh, my God.
Couldn't cope.
Said, quote, Black Lives Matter alienates normal voters.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, that is just
sure. We talk a lot about Donald Trump, but what about Netroots Nation? What about that those crazy people over there? And
I want to address this issue of Netroots Nation and what happened and what is happening. Washington Post called this the Democratic Party and Black Lives Matter are having a courtship issue, and I think they're making the same mistake. The mainstream media is making the same mistake they made with Black Lives Matter that they made with, frankly, the Tea Party in some respects. Wow, it's a brand new movement that just sprang out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, oh my gosh, look at this. Black Lives Matter, it's brand new, and we don't know how to predict what they'll do next. No, it didn't. Black Lives Matter may be a response to issues that have been brought to light because of technology.
Right.
And a group of people who have new avenues for communication because of technology.
Mm-hmm.
And there also may be new people. I mean, unlike the Tea Party, there are new people in it because demography.
Yep.
And the leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement, many of them are young.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there may be new people learning and using technology in new ways that it may be unpredictable how this pans out.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that Black Lives Matter is somehow some new sprung from nowhere movement is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's just absolutely not true. When I watched Netroots Nation and Jose Antonio Vargas on the stage, he was the moderator.
Right.
And he is probably, that I would guess, the most famous undocumented immigrant in America today.
Living in at the moment, yes.
Yeah, living in at the moment. And when I watched that, I thought to myself, okay, this is a ceremony by which we adjust to the Obama coalition without Obama.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a wake. It can be a remarriage. It can be a reaffirmation of a tense relationship.
Yeah.
But I don't think we need to see it or frame it as somehow bad because parts of it make us uncomfortable.
Which I want to make sure I understand. Which part? The actual Netroots thing or the larger...
Yeah, well, the interruption of Netroots and, that whole process. Uh-huh. And particularly among people like us, white liberals who support Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we as liberals, mm-hmm. Need to apologize for the tensions that are going on. And the mainstream media wants us to be on the defensive about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's bad optics,
right,
to interrupt a show. But I feel that what's going on is that we are reforming our coalition and figuring out how it's going to work while facing a loss.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
We are losing Barack Obama as a president,
mm-hmm.
and that is a loss.
Yep.
Just like losing a parent or a... We're losing the leadership of someone who brought us together.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how Larry Wilmore is calling this the unblackening.
Yeah.
You know, showing a picture of the White House and saying the unblackening is happening. And it is okay for us to have a certain amount, all of us, to have a certain amount of mourning about that.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking, too, and I hate to bring this up because so many commenters have said what a white privilege movie this is. This movie Inside Out, the Pixar movie, which I took you and your mother to.
Yes, you did.
For my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen it with the kids and I took you to see it. The idea that being happy all the time and being forced happiness is, and I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but the theme of the movie is this 11-year-old girl is asked to keep a happy face by her parents.
Uh-huh.
And she struggles with that. And and I'm sure you've seen ads and clips. If you haven't seen the movie yet, you should go see it. The struggle within her own mind of trying to stay happy all the time and finding that to be a losing battle because she's facing a lot of stress.
Yeah, and loss.
And loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are going through in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
We are losing something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see that as a negative. That the tension and the awkwardness of that is part of who we are.
Yeah.
And we don't have to apologize for it. But I do think that it helps to face all of that with a sense of humor. And I loved the hashtag Bernie So Black came out.
Did. I know you did. I heard you laugh.
I know some people took it. It bothered me so much to see some Sanders supporters say, you know, you shouldn't make fun of Bernie with Bernie So Black because he's supported the civil rights for 50 years.
Yes.
And the counter to that of what has he done for us lately? You know, that's not the argument.
No.
The argument is that there's going to be tension as there always has been. This is not something new.
Right.
Between white liberals and black activists,
mm-hmm.
and Barack Obama bridged that gap and brought us together, and he's going to be gone, and we have to readjust based on that.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. That doesn't mean we can't work together. That doesn't mean there's not going to be times when we're just pissed at each other.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because that's who we are.
Well,
and I just want to mention that my favorite Bernie So Black
tweet. That's right. Yeah.
Bernie So Black, Hillary Clinton is taking his vote for granted.
Yeah. that
go
brilliant.
And look at, if you haven't seen that hashtag, if you've been off Twitter like I have been,
mm-hmm.
the Bernie So Black tweets are just funny.
And that's the point. The point is a light touch. Funny, and this is another thing, another in there somewhere, not in the same level of Barack Obama, but mm-hmm. we are preparing to lose our media.
Yeah.
Jon Stewart is not going to be on television in a couple of weeks.
Right.
Gone.
That's right.
And he really is our Walter Cronkite.
Yeah.
And he really is the guy who's been carrying the battering ram
mm-hmm.
of, can you fucking believe that your media is this bad and your politicians are this craven for a really long time? And he's going away. And it's going to be very hard to frame issues without that deft comic touch.
Yep.
Because that deft comic touch is oftentimes all we really have.
Yeah, and Larry Wilmore is doing a very good job, I think, of from a black perspective, and from and having many black voices on his show, with a light touch, teaching all of us what we need to open our eyes to.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wanted to mention Jose Antonio Vargas, who again was the moderator at Netroots. He has just released a documentary on MTV called White People. I just watched the trailer this morning. It is a documentary where he interviews white millennials about what it means to be white. And, you know, that sounds almost like it should be sponsored by the Klan, right? I mean, if you took if you wanted to take it that way.
Or The Onion, frankly.
Or The Onion. Again, I haven't watched the whole thing. I've only seen the trailer. But the discomfort, again, the discomfort of young white people who have been taught to appear sensitive, being asked to talk about their white privilege and how hard that is, because they don't want to let go of their white privilege, but at the same time, they don't want to acknowledge that it exists. And there's one clip in this trailer where he says, let's all be uncomfortable together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's tears and there's... You know, I would love to see what Amy Schumer does with her self-parodying of white girls is kind of perfect and would dovetail nicely with this. But listen up. MTV aired this documentary opposite Sharknado 3.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
which was opposite Mr. Robot.
Which was opposite Mr. Robot.
So, you know, buried.
Buried. So... And I'm sure, I mean, television has changed. You weren't locked into watching anything at one time. There's lots of, I mean, Sunday night, I have to watch the other half of Sunday night TV on Mondays at some point anyway, because there's too many good shows on. But what it's called White People, MTV, Jose Antonio Vargas, and I'm sure it's online. I'm sure it's on demand. It's... To me, it's an interesting way to, I think his purpose, as he says in the trailer, the purpose is, you know, nobody wants to talk about race. Let's just talk about our own race for a minute. And when you do that and you open up that can of worms that way, it's uncomfortable. And that's all right.
It's all right, except.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that what happened at Netroots Nation, in the context of the larger history of that event, is a clear success for activists, and good for them. This is what activists do. The idea of an activist blocking traffic, for example, is not to be polite.
Mm-hmm.
It's to block traffic and call attention to your issue.
Yep.
And I completely understand that. I think from an organizational point of view, Netroots Nation completely screwed up. They failed very badly. They didn't just honor protesting. They didn't just let them do their thing. And from what I understand, the protesters were there, some of them, because Netroots Nation flew them in.
Mm-hmm.
They had helped organize to a certain degree. There were panels for their issues. There were lots of panels for lots of people's issues. And it wasn't like they had to crash the gates to get in there to tell people about their protest.
But I don't think they were crashing the Netroots Nation gates. I think they were crashing the Face the Nation gates.
Well, then go do it on Face the Nation.
But you can't get on Face the Nation unless you crash the gates at Netroots Nation. That's the point.
And that's fine. And again, as activists, they're doing what activists do.
Mm-hmm,
the minute Mr. Vargas turned the microphone over to the protesters, game over. There was this was no longer and if I were a candidate and had been invited, I've got 20 other things to do. But you invited me to address the issue of immigration to a large audience of people who pretty much agree with me. And at the last minute, you decide, you know what, we're going to pull the rug out from under you.
And there's often an argument in activist communities between making social change simply by raising awareness and having community.
Right.
And creating an effective campaign to change legislation
right.
and influence power.
Yeah.
And so Netroots Nation is in conflict with itself if it wants to be a platform for or provide a platform for Democratic presidential candidates to appear.
Yeah.
And at the same time, want the ability to disrupt that to be honored.
Yeah.
And when you do, when you try to do both of those things at the same time, it makes you look weak and not with any sense of direction.
It looks makes you look ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really well put. That is exactly my conflicted feelings over it.
Mm-hmm.
I have walked away from Democratic/liberal/independent organizations because they stopped focusing on their mission.
Yeah.
Their mission was to effect this change, to enact this policy, to get politicians to sit with them and listen to them and answer their questions. They didn't have a lot of influence, but they had some.
Mm-hmm.
And I've walked away from organizations where a single issue group decided that taking down the organization for the sake of their issue, no, we're not going to be a coalition. No, we're not going to be a group of people. We're going to talk about my goddamn issue, period. And that's all we're going to be about, was more important than anything else.
Including the initial mission of the organization.
Yeah, they really,
which was to talk to politicians, right?
Because, you know, because yelling at someone is a great way to change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or get them on your side, or if they're on your side, to get them to commit to voting your way or whatnot. I remember something a critic said, I think it was Roger Ebert, said about Mulholland Drive,
mm-hmm.
David Lynch. It's another David Lynch experiment that didn't break the test tube.
Mm.
It's a really volatile combination. All alliances, all coalitions are volatile because you have different people with different agendas, many of whom feel that their particular issue is not being given enough focus.
And I think the separation of economic justice and racial justice, and recognizing that sometimes those are the same time and often they're not,
mm-hmm.
was a big deal.
It was.
That helps the conversation along, I feel. I don't want to be Pollyannish about this. I understand that I said, you know, it's okay for us to feel tension and be angry and yell at each other and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't stop black women from being pulled out of their cars,
nope.
and found dead in a jail cell.
Nope.
That doesn't, you know, kumbaya doesn't stop that.
Exactly.
And I think the urgency that's being expressed is, look, a policeman can kill me anytime they want to.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're seeing. If you're black, a policeman can, you know, for failure to signal a lane change, you can wind up dead in 3 days.
Or for nothing.
That.
For carrying Skittles or nothing.
Yeah,
yeah, you can, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So there's an anger and an urgency about that anger that needs to be recognized.
Larry Wilmore, the Larry Wilmore show last night, made a really good explanation, sort of a Cliff's Notes version,
mm-hmm.
a short version of why the Black Lives Matter is an important,
yeah.
a really important distinction.
Yep. Yep. And how unnecessary and patronizing saying all lives matter is, beside the point.
Right. That's exactly. That's beside the point. And it is a way of playing a shell game with the specific urgent issue of no, we're not talking about all lives. We're talking about this specific group of people who are suffering the specific attacks and injury and oppression and discrimination. And we need to draw attention to this issue. And that's entirely legitimate, and I agree with it. Where your message gets lost is when you decide that we're going to interrupt another group who has another legitimate set of grievances and policy issues that we have specifically set aside this room to talk about in. Because, no, screw that. We're talking about what I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, wait a minute. We just talked. That breakout session was yesterday. Yeah, but that's not enough. We're going to take over it now because everyone knows the spotlight is on this room today, because that's mm-hmm. where the spotlight for the organization is going to be, where Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley show up. If anything's going to make a headline, that'll make a headline. And as an activist, you head for the headline. You head for the spotlight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you got to make up your mind or you look silly if you are.
Well, and they had invested in having Vargas come and be the moderator to talk about immigration, right, and to talk about Latino and Hispanic immigration rights.
Uh-huh.
And that was hijacked by and who was, someone emailed you and said, yes, it is the People's Front of Judea, the yeah. Judean People's
no, that
Front.
Was, that was that, my he agreed with me.
He agreed with you.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's there's a certain again, I've been through this before. I've been part of organizations where this dynamic played out to the point where the organization stopped being functional.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it couldn't get its shit together enough to focus on getting policies enacted and people elected. I don't know that that's going to happen. But part of me was just like, I wonder what happens next year when this is in Ferguson. Or not in Ferguson, I apologize. It's St. Louis, very near Ferguson. Right. And the focus is on, I don't know what the topic is. I think it's going to be structural racism or discrimination, et cetera. That area of conversation. And
someone hijacks it from
the LGBT group
or immigration
or immigration.
It comes back, you know, tit for tat. We're going to interrupt your group.
We're going to, you know, we've set aside this room.
Right.
You know,
there's
10 of the rooms. There's 20 of the breakout sessions. There's 30 other things where we've all been having a conversation. This particular forum and this day, we're talking about this subject. And you have, you know, Cornel West and Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm making that
having
up.
A big
know.
Fight. And
up on
Reverend
stage.
Al comes in and won't give up the microphone.
And Reverend Al, whoever, they're on stage having this conversation about the subject that's on the marquee.
Yeah.
And in marches the LGBT group, or in marches the immigration group, or in marches whoever else, and says, no, we're talking about my issue now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm just going to keep interrupting you until we talk about what I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the dynamic you're going to allow to occur over and over again, then that's fine. That is a kind of event that would be interesting to attend. But it's not an event that policymakers or people running for office are going to come to. They're going to avoid it like the plague because there's no upside to them.
And this is what happened. You know, the difference between what the Occupy movement did in terms of failing as a national movement.
Uh-huh.
To move needles, and what they were capable of doing at the grassroots level with mortgages and buying up debt, and they're still doing that.
Well, and
they're really making a difference
and dragging the spotlight to talk about income inequality,
right?
And
the 99%, which they did change the conversation.
Absolutely.
So it boils down to what do the organizers of Netroots Nation want it to be?
Right. And it has to
and
be.
If you don't know the answer to that, or you are in flux about the answer to that, then your meeting is going to look bad from the outside.
You'll always end up tripping over yourself.
Yeah, you will never live up to what your potential is. Mm-hmm. And that's easy for us to say, not organizing this particular conference.
Right.
There needs to be a decision made as to whether you're going to be in the world or of it.
Yeah. Well,
is that a good way to put it?
And how do you define relevance and effectiveness?
Yeah, right, right.
If you define relevance and effectiveness, pulling together a diverse group of people to have a, you know, in high school, I was in an alternate high school for a few years. And there was we had our town hall meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called that. And it was, you know, 50 people of various backgrounds, pulled together, and it was organized by ex-hippies, and it was organized, and it was always a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could never the rule was you always had to achieve a consensus, and there was always somebody who didn't want to go back to that park because my dog died there. Okay, well then let's nothing ever got done. The problem with it, it was fun to sit around for 3 hours and talk about issues of importance to this person or that person. But it was a terrible way of getting anything moving, getting anything done, getting a picnic planned or a play staged or a person elected. So if what you want to do is provide a place for people of similar interests and interlocking affiliations and generally on the same side to get together once a year, have a party, talk about stuff that's important to them. That's great. That's a wonderful thing. There's a lot of virtue in that. And if that's all you want to do, then that's fine. But the people who are coming there are politically engaged. And at some point, I have to assume they would like a policy prescription. They would like something to change. And the way that you change things is, frankly, through the political process. And if you don't want to affect the political process, if you want to alienate the people who are in that, if you want to make sure that there's no incentive for them to ever come and talk to your people again, then that's fine. But at the other end of that, don't get that nobody pays attention to your issue because you've gone out of your way to tell them that you don't really care about them or their electoral issues or the problem of getting X number of votes or Y number of whatnots because you're not in it for that.
Yeah.
So, that's just sort of goes with the territory.
Well, and that's why I was sorry that there wasn't a screening of Bulworth at Netroots Nation where Bulworth stands up and says, you're never going to get rid of someone like me.
Exactly.
I'm a roadblock to what you... I'm a Democratic senator, and I'm a roadblock to what you want to accomplish because I'm subservient to money.
Right.
Exactly. Period.
So tell me... how you're going to help me fix this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me that it's mine to fix. Tell me how – identify three or four things you think are the actual addressable things about structural racism, which is true and exists and is mm-hmm. awful. How do we fix that? How does a president who isn't a king address those issues? And let's talk about how we solve these problems because this is not just a gathering of activists, is a gathering of policy wonks. Fine. Yep. What do we do policy-wise to fix these issues?
We'll talk more about this, and I'm sure we're going to get mail about it.
I've already gotten mail about it.
You've already gotten mail about
I've gotten mail from people who are dear. And by the way, we're probably, if we can save the pennies and make the arrangements, probably going to be at Netroots Nation because it's really close to our home next year.
It's 2 hours from our house by car.
Yeah. So we're probably
in St. Louis. So,
and these are our people. This is a family fight.
Yeah.
But I think it is. I have quit liberal organizations because they forgot that the first rule of politics is you have to win.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Safina. Safina is very fluffy and a wonderful, great-hearted cat. So go visit Safina at our Facebook page and website. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. We need more internet kitties, so please send them in. You can also write to both of us at proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to write us. We do love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise. And I have letters. We get letters from overseas. This past couple of weeks, we've gotten a letter from Hawaii and a letter from Alaska.
Yeah.
So that's kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget that we love it when you shop local. But if you're not shopping local and you're shopping on Amazon, please use the link at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, because that benefits our podcast. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution, and you can too. Again, see our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal, postal address, and Amazon link information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that.
Yes.
Hey, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Oh, well, golly, Internet Kitties hope it's not too late for Tim Pawlenty and Fred Thompson to climb on that debate stage.
Let's think about living. Think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University. The quiz portion of our show is taking a break this week.
Yes.
And we have a lot of TV shows to talk about, starting with Mr. Robot, which is the best show on television right now, in my personal opinion.
It is. Just period. End of sentence. Next show.
Yeah. And what really did you good. Say about it last night? You said it's, first of all, the sense of place is so specific.
Yeah, they have really, really taken a lot of time to do what True Detective did in its first season, which is build a landscape that's extremely memorable and specific, mm-hmm. that you are never in doubt where you are. It might be a fictional place. In fact, you know, it probably is a fictional place. But from the offices of Evil Corp to the Coney Island hacker base to Steel Mountain.
And Elliot's apartment. I mean, Elliot's I think the contrast between Steel Mountain and Elliot's apartment. Mm-hmm. But that's that the camera goes from one to the other in the last episode. And I noticed, yeah. I noticed how claustrophobic Elliot's apartment is compared to this building that has a road in the middle of it, you know, for yeah. trucks. So and has a warehouse that's larger than many shopping malls, you know, this huge data yeah. storage place where there's nothing but space.
I noticed something just everything a director does, if they're a good director, is on purpose. Mm-hmm. The very clear distinction between where the good guys live and operate, or the civilians live and operate, mm-hmm. and where the bad guys.
Yeah.
The good guys have analog reality all around them.
Mm-hmm.
They meet in a library.
Yeah.
That's full of books, an old library full of books. One of our protagonist's work friend, her father's place is full of books.
Books, yeah.
The place where they meet up is full of analog games.
Yeah.
It's full of skee ball games and old pinball games. And the digital world is there, yeah. but it's – and then where the bad guys congregate is by and large almost all digital.
Yep.
It's all touchscreen. It's all run on computers. It's all clean and white. But even the guy who took over as chief technology officer – his home is, there are analog things there. There are antiques there, but they're on display.
Yeah.
They're not
yeah.
for use. They're not, they're totems. They're yeah. little yeah. things that, items of value because they're collectible, but they're not really used by anyone.
I hadn't thought of that before you started talking about it. There is a difference between the data storage at Steel Mountain and the data storage at Dad's house,
yes.
which is shoeboxes full of bills from Evil Corp.
Right.
And the data storage is there and is found and is discovered and is going mm-hmm. to be dealt with in some way. Mm-hmm. But it is analog. It is on paper. It is tree killing. It is, and you cannot destroy it. The effort to destroy that record is what this show is about right now.
Your allies, the revolution. I don't want to give too many spoilers away. Just the revolution depends on a confederation of interests between different groups, and one of those groups is not cooperating.
Yeah.
This also broke a weird internal wall in that Christian Slater interacted with people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now you can still; it could still be a case very much like Scanner Darkly,
uh-huh.
where Keanu Reeves, that's a Philip K. Dick book that was turned into a pretty good movie, not great movie, a pretty good movie, with Woody Harrelson, by the way, uh-huh. and Keanu Reeves and Robert Downey Jr., where a guy, undercover cop, has been taking this Philip K. Dick drug that's split his brain.
Uh-huh.
And it's made him schizophrenic. And by day, he's a cop chasing a drug dealer. By night, he's the drug dealer who's paranoid about this cop chasing him.
Mm.
He keeps forgetting that he's both guys. And it's still quite possible that the interactions, that at least two of the characters, and I'm thinking maybe even three of the characters,
don't really exist.
Yeah. Maybe even the girl doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Because she seems to come and go pretty easily in his
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
It's a very confident show,
mm-hmm.
as the boys at Grantland have pointed out. And that's a very good word for it. It's extremely confident. Because the director knows exactly where he's going, has a very clear idea of where he's going and why he's getting there. It might end badly. It might end like Lost. I don't know. But it's really interesting to watch them try this trick of perceiving most of the show through the lens of one character, not over his shoulder, but through his eyes. And yet you jump to other characters completely. And so it's not first person entirely. It's almost like a floating second person. You can be here or there or third person limited as opposed to third person omniscient. You go into someone's head, but then you know what his boss is doing or his rival is doing or the villain is doing. One of the other features of the show, we counted yesterday, there's like five plots going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Five different plot lines. True Detective is dying.
Well, and let's switch to that one now. Because True Detective, although I will say this week's episode of True Detective, all of a sudden they sort of boiled down all of the motivations. Mm-hmm. So we know exactly what every character wants and why they want it. This episode to get to that point, which I thought was quite late.
I would argue that I would agree with you. I would say that in Mr. Robot, you have five different plot lines, each of which is distinct and memorable and makes sense. Mm-hmm. And in True Detective, you have God knows how many. And the motives of people are – a lot of the motives are still unclear. Mm-hmm. I was just glad they threw me a life raft. Yeah. Like, oh, your son.
Yeah, you want to keep your son. Yeah, that's a good one.
This is the old one, find the girl. Right. Find the girl. Right. It's very simple. They threw us a couple of motives that you could clearly understand. And I was grateful that someone finally remembered that human beings have to be motivated by things that motivate human beings and threw us something. But I would like to point out Paul Woodra's magic bag of money.
What is that?
He had $20,000.
Who is Paul Woodra?
Paul is the cop, the motorcycle cop.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right.
And
okay.
He's one of our four or so protagonists. Mm-hmm. And the episode jumps 66 days past the biggest shootout in
L.A. California. History. Yeah, yeah.
And their lives have changed, but not very much. And it's almost as if they were building this show. And, the plot construction crew was sort of coming through and they were taking pieces of old Raymond Chandler novels and some David Mamet dialogue, just building shit. And it didn't make any sense. It was kind of sloppy. It looked like it really should have been someone else should have had a pass at this, two or three passes at this, because this is not coming together at all. But they got to a point where they said, holy shit, there's no reason for this guy to go back to where he was. Mm-hmm. So, shit, what are we going to do? Let's make him need some money. Yeah, that'll work. That's a great idea. So we will reverse engineer this bag of money that we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. That he has, as a cop, for some reason, stored in the home of his mother, who's the worst mother since Angela Lansbury.
Yeah, she really is.
In Manchurian Candidate.
Manchurian Candidate, I was going to say.
Completely untrustworthy, drunk, vicious, monstrous person. He lives in apparently a 10x10 trailer with her.
He had his own place with his girlfriend.
But for some reason.
And he stored this massive amount of stolen money from the war.
Uh-huh.
In her trailer. And she's an alcoholic. I mean.
and it's been there for 4 years, apparently.
Wow.
And
it hasn't.
No, the plot guys just put it there.
Yeah.
Because they suddenly realized there's absolutely no motivation for him to go back and get back into the shitty job that he had before. There's no reason for him to do that at all. Mm-hmm. So we're going to make a motive out of thin air. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be because you need the money.
Well, hopefully people realize by this time there are spoilers, but his girlfriend's going to have a baby, so that's his motivation, is that he needs money to raise a family.
Mom, you know that bag of money I stored in your place 4 years ago? Where is it, man? I mean,
that was really a stupid scene.
if Richie Cunningham going upstairs, or Richie Cunningham's brother going upstairs and disappearing forever...
Yep.
This was Richie Cunningham coming back downstairs for his brother. Yeah. Coming back. Yeah. He's like, where that? What the hell? Who's this guy? And really, they're throwing a bunch of relatively new characters into the mix Now there's some diamonds that someone took a picture of for some reason. And, you know, if it's the big sleep, I don't care who killed Sean Regan.
Yeah.
Because who killed Sean Regan is entirely secondary to the world of corruption and blackmail and drugs and prostitution. And so, you know, and if there had if this had been a show about how four really dysfunctional people managed to either wreck each other's lives or come together or figure out a way to – that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But this is – my notes to myself was death by Mulligan.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, death by MacGuffin.
Yeah.
They keep throwing MacGuffins at you that are suddenly supposed to matter. And if you had any investment in the characters, they would matter.
Yep.
But the characters are so abstracted and so bent and so fake that and this again is where season one really just stands out, because the specificity of where they were and who these people were and what their motives were was what the show was all about.
Driftglass, speaking of investment.
Yes.
Let's talk about Halt and Catch Fire.
Sure.
Because there's some investing going on there, all kinds of investing.
I believed in this little show back when everyone hated it. Actually, I kept waiting for it to turn a corner the first time it was out of the box, and it didn't.
Yeah.
It failed really, really badly. It failed to become anything that is of interest. It's like there was a story under there somewhere, but they didn't know what it was.
Well, focus on the current episode.
Yeah.
That happened this week.
Well, this week there's they have their pony stolen.
Mm-hmm.
The bad guy is now the bad guy. And the nice people who have been trying to put together a software community, a social media / gaming network, they can't figure out which to do, and so they do both, has been hijacked, has been taken away from them. The bad guy stole their network, stole their software, bootlegged the entire thing, locked them out of their own network, locked them out of their own software, hired a little cohort of hackers, of coders, to steal what was theirs. And since what was theirs existed only in the fantasy realm or the surreal realm on his network, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
They're locked out of their own invention. Their communities, they can't get in and tell people to stop. They're up against it. That's what you do with protagonists. If you want to keep a drama going, you put them up against it. You threaten their thing. You threaten their cause or their wealth or their treasure. You take from them. And this is, we've taken away the thing they value most. And by someone who appears to be beyond their reach, too powerful to be taken on, too wealthy for them to stand up against. But I think for me, Gordon is the more interesting character, most interesting character last week, not the most overall, but he's really turning into a Philip Dick kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
Who's becoming, due to brain damage.
Yeah, not the least of which is because his brain is untrustworthy.
Exactly.
And that's very Philip K. Dick. Yeah.
And he's becoming, suddenly they really drew this character well, because all of his nerd friends that he's starting a company with God, I know those people. And the guy with the pink shirt who comes back and brags how it is out in California. And turns out he's fronting because he's old now.
Yeah.
And the people out there aren't interested in his nerdy opinions. Mm-hmm. They're all 25 and he doesn't want to stand and be talked down to by a bunch of children.
Mm-hmm.
And Gordon is becoming really desperately paranoid and angry. And it really is a very interesting character, because he is, you can see the mistakes he's making. And you can see his brain convincing himself that wasn't his mistake.
Yeah.
That there must be a conspiracy out there somewhere that's causing all this to happen, is causing these failures and mistakes and glitches. And his own software upstairs is what's actually screwing up. And doing that really well with essentially a secondary character is hard to do. And Philip Dick does it really well. And I tip my hat to them for making Gordon an interesting character by screwing with his software, his mental software. And that's all I'll say. Other than it has been a delight to see a show that was left for dead. Somebody sift through it and found what was really decent about it and interesting and made a show about that. And
yeah.
I don't remember that ever happening.
Yeah.
So way to go. Way to go, AMC.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, Blue Gal. We're approaching our 300th episode.
We are. Yeah. This is episode 294. We've only got 6 more weeks. We'll have a 300th episode.
Yeah.
And in between time.
Yeah.
We will have been married 4 years.
Yes. That's, so.
August 19th is our 4-year anniversary.
Yes.
We will have been married longer than Ted Cruz is going to be president.
Or Donald Trump combined.
Or Donald Trump combined are going to be president.
The combined lengths of the
Trump-Cruz administration.
Trump-Cruz-Palin administrations. We're married longer than that.
So we're married longer than that. And they said it wouldn't last.
Yeah. No, they didn't.
No, they didn't. No. We knew it would last. All right. So let's do the political podcast.
Yeah. Now. I love you.
I love you, too. Bye.